Hello?
Hello, this is Mike Jarrett with Tower Records Magazine calling Bill Laswell.
Could you hold on 1 second?
Sure.
Hello?
Hey.
Sorry.
I'm working on a piece on Miles Davis's In a Silent Way, the complete In a Silent Way sessions.
Right.
From 68 and 69. I wanted to know if I could ask you a few questions about that.
Yeah.
When you were working on the project on Panthalassa, you worked, what, with the 8-track masters that were assembled on those, I guess that Tio assembled from the sessions, is that correct?
I worked with the 8 tracks that had been dumped onto a 24-track, safety, had been dumped onto a 24-track analog.
Oh, okay.
But there were 8 tracks.
Uh-huh.
8-track recording.
Now, when they originally recorded those things, were the tracks isolated at all, or was there just tremendous amount of bleed?
There's 8 tracks, and there's 8 musicians.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, everybody has a track, including the drums are on 1 track.
Okay.
As far as bleed, there actually was a lot of separation, surprisingly.
Oh.
In most cases, I would say it was well recorded, and the only thing that's flawed on those recordings are at some point you hear talking, which is actually on the original record.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a part where something falls off the piano, like a bottle or something, and I never knew what that was, but that's obviously an accident. So you hear those things, but as far as separation, it's not really that bad.
Oh, okay. And most of the talking, I assume, like I can hear it on the original version of it's about that time now. It sounds like Miles walking around and telling people to repeat like a figure or something
like that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, really in these remixes, I'm curious just about how your ear works on these. This is one of the this is the time that you work with Tony Williams drums, and as far as I know, I guess it's the only time that you worked remixing his drums when he was on Miles' stuff. Is
yeah,
that correct?
On Miles' stuff, yes.
Right, right. What did you see as he sounds really different on the In a Silent Way sessions than he did, let's say, even on Via de Kilimanjaro.
Well, if you notice on In a Silent Way, he chooses not to play. He sort of plays a hi-hat figure.
What's your theory on that?
Theory was, from what I was told by the musicians on the session, is that he was pissed off about something, and I don't remember what the conversation was, but he just had a little bit of an attitude, and that's what he decided to do.
Almost that rock straight four on the hi hat.
He just didn't play the drums. He just kept time.
Yeah.
And that's because of some whatever feelings he had about something that had happened within the session, and he was a little mad about something and had some kind of an attitude. There's another version of that with Joe Chambers playing, where he plays a full drum kit.
Oh, okay.
Huh. I don't know if that's been made available, but that did exist on a multi-track.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
But it wasn't like the hi-hat figure. It was actually a full kit.
Full kit. Uh-huh. Now, when you worked on those recordings, were you aware that what became Peaceful, the specific track, and then I think the entire album was originally titled Morning Fast Train from Memphis to Harlem.
I didn't know that. No.
I mean, it sounds just like it was kind of a confirmation when I read that, because I'd always thought that hi-hat figure especially sounded like a...
Yeah, a motor or something.
Yeah, yeah. To what extent do you understand In a Silent Way is unique in jazz history, and to what extent do you understand it as maybe, I don't know, one way to ask it is just that. Do you think it's unique?
Well, you got to look at the time. It was unique in that it kind of introduced atmosphere, it introduced ambient approach at that time. It introduced also minimalism and repetition in terms of drum figures, rhythm, and bass pulses. So it's radical in that it brings all those things out, and that the other instruments float in and out as you, when you hear the record, you don't hear the actual head that they were trying to play. You hear the phrasing, that was played around a head that no one ever got to hear.
Mm-hmm.
So the head doesn't exist on the records that we heard, but it does exist on the multitrack.
Right.
But it didn't quite come together musically, so it was omitted from the recording. So what you get is this real floating ambience of people just sort of playing in and out of focus, but because the actual head has been taken out. So what you really get is, to me, it's more of a beginning of a musical ambient
mm-hmm.
recording.
I mean, there's times I think that what happens in so many discussions, it's almost unavoidable for me as a writer, you know, to sort of look at its kindred spirits, you know, or look at its kindred albums, and I can either go with, you know, Miles Davis's earlier albums or what happens with that crew that's in the studio at that time, what they will end up doing later. But there's also a part of me, like you're implying there, that it may be... Maybe these sort of, I think of them as almost like arboreal, tree-like sort of genealogies, that's just a really dumbass sort of way to work on the thing, that in a silent ways, its kindred albums might be something like Another Green World.
Yeah, absolutely.
What would you see as other, I mean, what are things that are going on there that would say, now this really makes it sort of the sibling of, and most people don't necessarily think of it as the sibling of, I don't know, I named Another Green World, but I'm, you know, at a loss for what else it might be.
Well, it's endless, really. I mean, there's so many different hybrids that came out of that influence. Another Green World is one. There's even a lot more. Sure, there's a lot more things that are even more ambient, and artists like Paul Schutz and people like that who have done ambient music but based on some of the rhythms and the feel and the figures and the tonalities of in a silent way. There's a lot, it's a huge influence on a lot of different hybrid musics, and Another Green World goes back quite a long time. That's not even that long after In a Silent Way,
right?
But there's been certainly 80s and 90s, there's been a lot of ambient recordings that feed off of that influence.
Come out of it, sure,
yeah.
Right.
And they really are influenced by the result, which is the recording that people hear. It's not the sound experience that really happened in the studio, because the studio, again, was based on a head that never materialized, the fact that Tony decided not to play the drums. All these things go into creating this event, which was captured on tape,
yeah,
which are accidental, stake-oriented, mood-oriented. They're not. It's not necessarily here's the composition and do your best. It's really based on all these other this other kind of energy.
Yeah, boy, that's fascinating. That too, that just that notion that you said about mistake,
yeah,
accident.
Yeah, it's exactly what determines that end result.
Because I think, you know, with the beginnings of multi-tracking, or even the beginnings of just magnetic tape, at the very first, magnetic tape is sort of understood as a way to fix mistakes. You know, somebody fucks up an ending, we'll
right.
fix it. But very soon, I mean, I think of it too with like with Elvis and those, you know, when he would just do take after take after take.
Right.
I think that what they're looking for is the fortuitous accident.
Yeah, sometimes. Well,
you know,
some people are looking for what they believe is the absolute perfect performance, you know, and then sometimes that judgment gets replaced by something that's totally irrelevant to the original concept as like a mistake.
Do you think that this method that was employed in the studio where apparently Miles would walk around, whisper to people, and then they'd play, and if the, you know, something broke down, they'd start up again, play, and then T.O. edits all that together, and then from that edit,
yeah,
then you get In a Silent Way. I mean, that's not exactly a pop methodology. Do you
well,
think
it is it, now, if you look at the way that sampling and DJ culture and hip-hop is done. I mean, the worst thing that can happen is someone has some music prepared. The best thing that can happen is that there's intuition and spontaneity and people feeding off of ideas they're hearing for the first time, which means that they're responding creatively, spontaneously, artistically, naturally, without too much premeditated thought toward structure, composition, or even rules.
Yeah.
Especially rules.
But I'm thinking that juxtaposition, though, of of some pretty intense improvising, and plus this sort of collage method.
Makes it unique. You have musicality and virtuosity, but also random elements and spontaneity, accidents that come out of nowhere, mm-hmm. and this, you know, the stubborn approach Tony took to it, as well as this sort of floating ambience, which is really there because of the lack of the center, which is removing the head and dealing with the things that floated around it. What you end up with, the result is the floating around and not the center.
It's certainly an approach that seems to almost be the repressed other of what jazz could do. I mean, yeah. Miles would do it again with Bitches Brew. He does it, you know, they do it with Jack Johnson. But
yeah, well, that was the first record, if you think about it, where all of a sudden it was about capturing the energy of the moment, the time, the feeling, what people were experiencing, not dealing with very elaborate composition, but more creating environments. Mm-hmm. That was really the first record that introduced that. It almost made the other approach seem really dated, really corny, really jazz as opposed to future.
Yeah. And then that's almost, like I'm saying, though, it's almost shut down. It becomes, it's that people, that becomes repressed.
Yeah.
Or it's just one of those avenues that doesn't, when it gets traveled down, like you're saying, with it gets explored by people like the ambient people in the 80s and 90s, like some of the things that you've done, or Paul Schutz, you know, you're saying it's dropped as an avenue of research almost.
Right.
You know, one of the things I remind on that initial title for the thing is that the morning fast train from Memphis to Harlem is that the first piece of music concrete was that Pierre Schaeffer thing that was a study of trains.
Right.
Why does that constant motor that is with trains or all kind of mechanical devices, why do you think that works really well for ambient?
Well, it gives it the pulse. It gives it the repetition. It becomes the ambience itself, really.
Mm-hmm.
It's the constant modulation of time. You're being presented to it in a way, it's so repetition. It's like it with Indian music. There's always the repetition of a drone, and that becomes the trance element. That becomes the movement inside. Sometimes you hear it, sometimes you don't, whether it's there or not. Sometimes you hear it after it's over. That's the trance element, just the repetition.
Yeah.
Which is true in all trance music, whether acoustic or techno or electronic or whatever. That underlying pulse is what draws people into it.
Right. Well, even with Schaeffer, I've always thought, I've tended to think that what he again sort of pulled back from that, almost like Eisenstein or someone, he decides to chop it up and make a montage.
Right.
He wants to sort of transcend those trance elements.
Right.
Rather than just letting the groove play out.
Right.
But Miles apparently at this moment was okay with just simplifying and letting a groove develop.
Well, that was the time. It was a transition time for him in terms of rhythm sections. If you think about it, again, that record being one of the pivotal transition points that opened up the ones to follow, whereas his references had more to do with repetitive music, soul music, R&B, Hendrix, Sly Stone, James Brown.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, listening to experimental electronic music on top of that, like Stockhausen, things like that. But his interest in the repetition had to do with youth culture, with street music, with what inevitably later on in time, 20, 30 years later, became experimental hip-hop.
Yeah.
It's just repetition.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to hear you do a James Brown remix. I bet you'd like to do it, too.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I made the mistake once. I was talking, actually, to Tio Macero, and I said, Tio, this was right when Panthalassa first came out.
Oh, yeah, he's very bitter.
I said, Tio, have you heard Panthalassa? Man, I love that record. what do you think?
Right.
I had to hold the phone like a foot away from me.
Yeah, he went crazy on he even goes crazy on Bob Belden and all those guys, too.
but it's really interesting, though, because I think it was somebody at Sony. It may have been Steve Berkowitz, who pointed me to a sentence from David Toop's book, Ocean of Sound, where T.O. said, well, I mixed it this way, but who's to say, you know, in 20 years that somebody won't do it a completely different way? And I, you know, it was like a, it was basically, he realized it's the logic of the technology, the logic of the medium.
Yeah.
And he saw that and actually advanced his sort of prophecy.
Right.
Then I guess became totally disgruntled that he wasn't part of it. But
yeah, that's really the main
thing. You know, that's, but what strikes me is that at that moment in 69, that they're actually following through on some of the logic of recording what's possible with tape, what's possible with multi-tracking.
Well, they really created that record with, you know, the potential there of the studio, of multi-track, of editing.
Mm-hmm.
And crossfades and whatever they could get away with. I mean, they used the same piece of tape twice in the Zonal piece.
Mm-hmm.
It's like when you hear that head,
right?
Then there's a kind of little moment of playing. Then you hear the head again. That's not a repetition of the head. That's actually a repetition of tape.
Right.
Same piece of tape.
Yeah, I was actually reading some of the old reviews. They were posted in the press kit, but you know. Martin Williams said, this is the worst edited album I've ever. And he noticed that. He's the only one that really notices it. But he hears it immediately as a mistake.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, thinking, gee, this is a hybrid form as being.
Well, he's at an advantage because in 69, I think most people, 9 out of 10, if not more, of people that bought records, that record included, no one thought like that. No one thought edit. They didn't think studio, tape machine.
Right.
They just thought music.
Right.
And so that became their music. They didn't know how it was made, like we don't know how most things are made, but they certainly didn't think studio manipulation, tape editing, and finding a result by way of using equipment as opposed to musical performance.
They didn't think paradigms.
I didn't think that way either.
I didn't either.
I used to hear the live stuff, which would have like brutal edits on
mm-hmm.
And it's just like one thing is going in one key, and then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, it's a different rhythm, a different key. And I always thought, that's incredible how they do that. But what's really even more bizarre is that live, he emulated that with the live band. He would do it with hand signals, and they would actually jump from one idea to another on a cue.
Yeah.
Which is influenced and created and made possible by the reference, which was the edit on the record.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah. It's like a game piece then too.
Yeah,
it becomes.
Exactly.
And some of them also have that feel to me of almost a self-generating music, that he could set something in motion, and that you almost had the possibilities of let's make just slight changes in the
right.
in a sound. Yeah, that whole idea of then imitating the technology and these sort of feedback loops is really, really amazing.
Yeah, and it goes on today. You find broken beats or fractured hip-hop beats, and there'll be actually live drummers that take the time to try to emulate a broken beat,
mm-hmm.
which essentially to anyone who calls himself a timekeeper would refer to that as a mistake or out of time.
Oh, yeah. I remember hearing an interview, I think it was with Robbie Robertson or someone, talking about a similar thing, but on guitar, you know, like, how in the world did they do, you know, and just practicing,
right.
to get it right. And in fact, it had been, you know, a studio manipulation.
Right.
Hey, well, listen, I don't want to keep you, but I really appreciate you talking to me about this recording.
Okay, well, this is for what?
It's for Tower Records magazine, Pulse.
Oh, when is that record coming out, the silent one?
Middle of October.
October.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's been bumped just a little bit, I think, to create a little distance between it and the Billie Holiday set that's coming out.
Right.
Yeah, so.
Okay.
I think October 16th, if I remember, middle of October, and this article is slated for October.
Okay, good.
Thank you, Bill.
All right, thanks.
All right,
bye.
Bye.